true, that spiritual, actual, factual answers to questions he asking. You find them inside you, beside you, reciting the records of Kashuk. We laughing, we drafting the passion through fabric. It's time for that comedy, dramedy, all of the fanciest, catchiest acronyms. Listeners, listen, we traveling. Consciousness is always unraveling. The reading you're having is mapping you back to your natural habitat. Abracadabra, it's magic, let's pass it. To top it off, the host are the classiest. Now, what were you asking for? All of the answers, what? All the answers.
All right, well, we're recording. Everything's recording.
Yeah.
Oh, Katie, you've been through it.
Yep. Yeah.
You, what the hell? You want to just dive right in and tell me what the hell's been going on?
Sure. I will say I did my homework. Oh. Do you remember what my homework was?
Did it have to do with, about Israel and Hamas and Palestine? Wow.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah.
I thought it was about our guest today.
I did that homework too.
You're all over it.
Very excited about our guest today. We'll get to that in a minute.
Meanwhile, you've been also doing family homework.
Yeah.
Do you want to share any of that?
I mean, yeah. I think, oh God, there's so much to say there. My stepmother passed suddenly. Eric and I were driving through Utah and we were heading down to Albuquerque to see my dad and stepmother for Thanksgiving. And while we were in Salt Lake City on top of a mountain, looking at the most beautiful vista I've ever seen, for real, the text came through from my sister. My mom died. And we were just like, she's 10 years younger than my dad. She was the most in shape person I know. Fit, no fat on her body, exercise. She's 72. She exercised 5 times a week. She's like, yeah. And my dad's almost 80 and like looks like shit, sounds like shit, still alive. He's had 3 strokes or 2 strokes and kind of heart attack. Like it makes no sense. It's the opposite of what you would think should happen. Like,
right.
Yeah.
Just a sudden just dropped.
Yeah. And we had, it's been a lot, like organizing, a lot to organize, like the autopsy, the funeral, the cremation, people flying in from all over the country. Where do we do the service? What kind of service? Then there was a second service because she's Buddhist. And it's been a lot.
Are you still in New Mexico?
Yeah. I'm going to be here till Thursday. That's why, listener, I don't have my excellent quality. I was so proud of myself before I went on this trip. I said to Cassidy, I checked in. Do I need to bring my microphone? We like unscheduled a taping. We've posted a repost last week, whatever it's fucking called. Cause then I was like, sweet, I don't have to bring my microphone. I'm not going to fuck up. I'm going to be prepared. Yay, we're all prepared. And then I had to stay an extra week. So I don't have the microphone anyway.
Yeah. So yeah, that's fun.
It's been really hard. I'll tell you the truth. Really good in a lot of ways and really hard in a lot of ways. Like, you know how tragedy brings people together.
Yeah.
Like an uncle that I'm sure I've talked about on here, Andy.
Yeah.
You know who I'm talking about?
I think I do. I'm staying neutral because there's some things about him that are famous.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Anyway, none of us have heard from him, seen him for like 6 years since all the bad shit went down.
He's your dad's brother.
My dad's brother that he's either guilty of or not guilty of. And the family's a little divided on that topic. He sort of vanished and moved to Japan, hasn't talked to anyone, and then heard about this and got on a plane and came here. And we were all like, okay, hi. I mean, so that was wild. And that's we could do a whole podcast on that. Then there's my dad's other brother and his wife who live in on the East Coast. And we haven't seen them in 10, 12 years, not for the same kind of reasons, just because life. 8 years, something, some long time. And they have trouble traveling and da, da, da. They were just like, hi, we're coming. They were just insistent. We're coming.
Wow.
My dad is the kind of person who's like, no, no, no.
Yeah.
You don't have to do that. And we're all like, yes, yes, yes. My sister and I. Anyway, so we're organizing this big thing and it's just been a lot of emotional ups and downs. And then of course I have emotional definition. And my sister does not. So I'm officially more emotional than she is, but she amplifies my emotions. So I'm more and more emotional when I'm around her. So it's just like, and then I, you know, all my childhood stuff is up because.
Childhood, his dad, right.
Yeah, because my dad's being my dad. And then I just, I have all my tools and I use them. You know, I have an Airbnb, a little bit away, beautiful part of town, happy in my own space.
Did Eric go back home?
Eric was here for a week. He flew back.
Oh, and you're going to drive back because you have your car, because there's no way you're flying back, right?
And it's funny because he left all his shit here because I could drive it back. Uh-huh. So he flew home with like a teeny tiny backpack.
Wow.
Which that's just funny. There's no problem with that. I just thought it was funny.
Yeah.
Anyway, and so how did I learn about Israel and Palestine, which I'd like to kind of focus on more? I feel like I want to do a whole, there's so much I could say about what I'm like learning and aware of. And oh my God, from this week, it's like we either go the Israel-Palestine conversation or we go this. Do you have a thought?
I mean, I honestly am ill-equipped to do the Israel-Palestine direction. I mean, I've continued to follow little bits and bobs, but I haven't done a deep dive on the greater context of everything. So, but if you feel drawn to jump into it, I'm here for it. But I honestly, I'm intimidated and I don't know about that topic. So.
All right. Well, I'll just say my sister is like very good at researching things like this and gets very interested in financial things about the world and wars and history and all kinds of stuff that I just avoid entirely.
Yeah.
So we went out last night just to bond and stuff and get some downtime together. And she filled me in on the whole history. And it was like, oh, okay. There's so much to say. It's huge, but I do feel better knowing more. I've realized that on this topic, what I want to do is hear like from five different people's perspectives who are well-educated, what happened, because there's so much back and forth over time that depending on who you hear it from,
yeah,
you're going to hear a very different story.
100%.
Sorry. I also got a cold.
Yeah.
So it's going great, Cass. It's going great.
It's killing. It's great. It's super. You sound beat.
Yeah, I'm beat and I'm emotionally beat and I'm like coming out of being sick, which is great for me. Like I couldn't have spoken to you 2 days ago. So much pain in my throat. But anyway, so we'll come back. We'll talk about that more some other time. But it's been interesting, like all different kinds of like family information is kind of coming out, like things my stepmother said about me in a supportive, loving way that I had no idea she felt.
Wow.
That nobody was saying to each other. They were like saying around the corners, you know?
Right.
And like Sarah helping me understand, like, no, she was a big cheerleader of yours. And I'd be like, what? What are you talking? Who? And then like getting an email from a friend of hers who also knows me, who was like, she was always your champion. And she spoke, and I'm going, she was?
Not to me.
Yeah. And that's big. And then like dealing with my dad inside of it, he's still my dad. And I can only do so much of my dad because he always makes me feel sad and unloved. And then I have to do my work and like love myself and remember I don't get that from him in the way that I wish I could and not to expect it. But if you hang out at the river, you're going to get wet at some point.
Yeah.
So there's only so much wading in the river you could do before you feel sad if it's not wet.
Right.
You know, and so I have to take a lot of space, but then I want to be present. And then my sister and I put up the Christmas tree, which was beautiful. But Susan used to put up the Christmas tree. And then there's all these cats and dogs in the house. And he's going to be alone in this big, beautiful house. And I'm bagging all of her clothes and we're donating them. And it's a lot.
Ooh, that's a lot. Ooh.
So, and then there's the way that the thing I wanted to name, I guess that was just a list of context, but I find myself having all this compassion arise for people in my life that have been shitty. I feel more compassion for my birth mother, not enough to communicate with her, but I just do feel for her. Like I feel for her. She suffered a lot. She lost her family. I would argue at her own hands. But she did. She lost her husband and her kid.
Yeah.
She lost her brother. She went through a ton in her life. She had a shitty, hard fucking life in a way. And in another way, a perfectly fine one. And I feel for her on that. And then like a friend of mine that I defriended on my 3-year Eat, Pray, Love journey, who I haven't really spoken about here, I've suddenly found myself just feeling a lot of empathy for her. It's like I got a lot of perspective on my dad's wife. Through going to this Buddhist ceremony we went to. She was a devout, certain kind of Buddhist. Kadampa. And we went there for a ceremony and it was beautiful. And every person, Cass, that came up to me, they all knew her. They all loved her. Everyone had a big story for me about how generous she was and how much she gave to the center. And she built this and she painted that and she designed this and she always called and she always checked in. And I'm just like, I'm thinking about that thing of how when you come home, you know, your family like gets the best of you and the worst of you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When you're at home, you see the alcoholism and you see the rage and you see the judgment and you see the fatigue and you see the joy and the gifts and the love. But when people go out of the home, they often like go do good works out there. And then you come home and collapse. And we see that.
Right. You don't, in a sense, you don't put up your quote best self, but that's not even the right, because that has judgment in it. But like you do have your public self, which can be loving and generous and all the things. And then you have your private self. And I think that's even true in different variations of public. Like we've talked about a particular casting person in our world that like I have such a specific relationship of generosity and support and you know, championing and all that stuff. And you and other people have stories of that person made me feel like the smallest I've felt in a year just by the way they said hi, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's hard for us to see that those are both true.
You mean it's the same person?
It's the same person. And neither of us is wrong in what happened.
No. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, right. And then it's a complicated thing to know more of the hard stuff about a person when every person is coming up to you praising them. And I'm like, it's so complicated because part of me is like, wow, thank you for telling me that, because it helps me really see her fullness. I see like the fullness of her through these people and what they're telling me. And just because someone dies doesn't mean they were a saint.
No, that's a huge thing. Did you ever read the book Speaker for the Dead?
No, what is that?
So the problem is it was written by a person who was wonderful and then gradually got more and more weird and paranoid. Orson Scott Card, who wrote Ender's Game. And then the first sequel to Ender's Game is this book called Speaker for the Dead, which takes place like 3,000 years after Ender's Game. But Ender has been in space, so time, blah, blah, blah. Who cares? He develops this concept called a speaker for the dead, which is an honest and true, a person who comes to a town when someone has died and asks and gets all the stories.
That's good.
100% of them, and tells them all back. Does not edit.
Wow.
And tells the truth.
That's pretty cool.
Of this person.
Yep.
So and that's the best way to honor them.
That's nice.
Is to tell the truth, the full truth.
I love that a lot.
Yeah. So you got an experience of that, but I wonder if anybody else did.
Bottom line is, I really want to emphasize, like, the majority of it has been me learning more about the beauty of this person and really getting to, I miss her and I wish I'd hung out a little more and I wish some of the dynamics at home were different in a way that would have allowed us to get each other better. I wish she had ever said any of the words she said to other people about me to me.
Why do people do that?
I don't understand it. I'm people think I'm weird all the time because I'll give you an example. Today, this is how I roll. Because I don't understand this exact thing and never have, I'm certainly overcompensating the other direction. So I like to call people out of the blue and be like, you know what? You are fucking great. Here's why. Thank you for this thing you did when I was 12, 100 years ago. You writing letters to people, being overly sharing of how great they are. Because I'm just like, this is like a theme in my life of like, say words, maybe say words to each other. How about if we like fucking say out loud how we fucking feel? Anyway, so I today shared on the Discord of my improv group in San Jose, like openheartedly. I openheartedly share with them, hey guys, I'm going to miss you this month. I had a loss in the family out here helping my dad. I started to really love you weirdos. Stay weird and I miss you and I'll be back soon. And thanks for doing shows without me. And inserted a little dick joke that was a reference to a thing. Barely any responses. I'm getting like little heart emojis from a few people.
People don't know what to do with that. It's hard.
With kindness and open-heartedness?
Yeah.
It's so fucked up. When I was in Access, one of the things they taught that was, I think, spot on, and to this point, my friend Meredith always really helps me remember this. She always boils it down. She goes, you have to remember, Katie, in this reality, people don't know what to do with enthusiasm.
Yeah.
People take enthusiasm all kinds of fucked up, stupid, judgy fucking ways, and they shut it down. Yeah. People want everyone to operate at this kind of null void of chill nothingness. And some of us are golden retriever puppies with a lot of feelings and enthusiasm. So it's a hard world out there with, if you've got emotional definition, and specifically if you have emotional authority. So I see you. If you're out there listening and you're not alone, and I just thank God for people who can hear it and hold it and just allow it to exist, because it's a hard place to be when you are exuberant and open-hearted and you just tell people the truth about how you vulnerably love them. Why the fuck does this reality have so much hard fucking time with that?
Well, I, as someone who is learning, I mean, I've always been, you know, pretty good at it, but I think my thing until very recently has been it to me goes,
you've shared this before,
yeah, this idea of contracts that are drawn by expressing love, that they're bullshit. It's a bullshit idea, but it's like it stops me, or it has stopped me in the past from, or even to the point of, like, you know, fearing that I might be lying to a tiny degree and not being sure of my own truth, you know, like. And I can't. So, like, you know, it's the problem of, like, why you don't talk to someone right after a play. You know, you don't go, that was great. Or you find out a way to do it. But I don't ever want to do that anywhere in my life. I don't want to go, I love you 100%.
Yeah.
When I'm like, do I? I'm not sure I do. But what can I want to, you know, and then I get lost in that construct. So even like replying to your email, people would be like, wait, how do I feel about Katie? I mean, she's cool and all, but I just barely know her. I don't feel like I can give her a huge, and then they never write back because they got lost in that thought. I don't know. I can't write their story, but that might be me in a lot of contexts, but I'm getting better at it. But it's a task. It's not, doesn't come naturally. It is a conscious tasking I do. I'm going to write that person a letter and tell them that they are good and loved. You know, it doesn't come naturally.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it makes me pretty sad. It just makes me sad. Like, yeah. Just makes me sad that I don't know. It makes me think of another thing. I had I've probably shared this on here before, but I had a Akashic Records reader, the one who taught me how to open the records, woman, Lisa Barnett. She did a read for me once and she's like, oh, you're super ancient soul. You've been around a lot of times and you're really weary, aren't you? And I went, can you say more about that? She was like, well, you're weary from how many lifetimes you've tried to, like, show people stuff about maybe don't bomb each other and peace is good and here's how to heal and we could laugh more. And you're just exhausted from lifetime after lifetime of, well, they still don't fucking get it. And I want to have perfect forgiveness for humanity. I want to have forgiveness. I want to be like, well, hey, this is they do the best they can with the tools they have. I don't have that yet.
Yeah.
I have frustration and anger that humanity has such a fucking hard time, which brings us back. I know our guest is here and we won't go here today, but it's a nice segue for next week into Israel, Palestine, because, I mean, getting a little more educated on it, I'm like, yeah, well, there it is again. Why do we keep trying? People suck.
Yeah.
And then I go, okay, well, I can't sit in that for too long. How do I get back to harmony, forgiveness, peace, showing up, giving because it benefits me to give. And because if you help one person, that's worth it. Blah, blah, blah. But when you fucking tried a lot.
Helping them, chasing. It's like fucking suck them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no. So it's important that as a spiritual teacher, I guess, it's important. I want to really do a better job this year. This is one of my commitments of, like, publicly sharing when I'm not spiritually fit, because everybody's not spiritually fit. Sometimes I am not in perfect forgiveness of humanity. I'm pissed at humanity right now. I hold a grudge. Fuck you, humanity. That's where I'm at.
Yeah.
That's okay. And then when I feel like getting out of that, I'll do some work on it and I'll come back to, like, yeah, that's how they are.
Yeah, people are also good.
And they're, some of them are great. And Cassidy exists, and my cat and my dog are cute.
And I love, and I can tell people I love them. It's, but boy, yeah. I have nothing to add to that, so I won't.
All right. Well, our guest is here. Let's see how this fucking goes.
This is going to be great. Welcome to our shithole.
No, I think it'll be good. He's cool. Okay, let's bring him in, and I'm going to.
And then we'll talk about whether we know him or not.
I do know him.
I do.
You know him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little.
Hey, what's up? Rami's rules. Wait, that's not how I started. Oh, well, anyway, it's Rami. There's someone that I work with who I like a lot and who I have a lot of connection to. And who is younger than me. And I feel them in a state of proving a lot. And not listening. And that bothers me. And it makes me prove and not listen. And so the thing that bothers me about them, I am also doing. What a surprise. And so now everyone's proving and not listening. Yeah, like I went to start to complain about them to myself. And I was like, oh shit, I'm doing that exact same thing. So anyway, I guess my goal now is to change that cycle and to start asking them questions. Because I want them to ask me questions, right? And but I'm not asking them questions either. And I'm not asking them questions because they're already telling me things about themselves. And so I'm like, now I'm done hearing about you. I want to talk. But anyway, the cycle is just a cycle now. So I'm going to try asking them questions and deeply listening and see if that helps shift the cycle to where the proving stops because their needs are being met. And that, maybe my needs can get met too. And my proving, if they stop proving, I'll stop proving. So I'm trying to help them stop proving. And I'm also simultaneously going to try to stop proving. Rami's rules.
Logan.
Hi.
Hi. We are recording. The way we do this, we should have told you, we probably didn't, is we talk for about half an hour before the guest comes on. So you're just entering in the midst of a conversation. And then we sort of talk to you about you and ask you some questions about you. And then do spiritual stuff or not.
Cool.
Logan, have you heard the podcast at all?
Yes, I just listened to the episode with Rami from whenever that was, earlier this last month.
Oh yeah, the recent one. Great.
Yes. And also your glasses are both, you all both have very good glasses on right now.
Thank Nobody you. Can
tell that.
I mean, I feel like ours are similar, you and me, Logan. So kind of. Yours is like the blue version of mine.
My glasses are like a mirror, basically. So they don't, yeah. These are the only pair of glasses that, these are like my first pair of glasses.
They're really cool.
So like if I were to stand right in front of you in a perfectly balanced way, it would look like you were wearing my glasses because I could line up my frames with your frames. There's some deep spiritual lesson there.
Absolutely. And lots of people are just kind of like, wow, like I like your glasses today. And I'm just like, it's the same glasses that it's always been. It's just a different light. And you are seeing new.
That's cool.
Anyway, I haven't seen either of you in a really long time.
Okay, you got to help me. I feel terrible because I'm like, I love Logan. We did that thing. What thing was that thing that we did?
So we worked at the Bay Area Polaris Festival, and that would have been in 2016. And it was a reading of a play called Non-Player Character by Walt McGough.
Of course it was. Thank you.
Yeah, and you were completely fabulous in it. You didn't have very many lines, but you show stealing as always. And but the first time that I saw you on stage would have been that play at Aurora Theater that Josh Costello directed where you played the clever maid.
Yes.
Do you know what play that was? Yeah. Do you remember the name of that play?
Yes. That's Fuck Me, David Ives. Fuckity shitballs.
It's the somethings. The liar.
It's not. Oh, now I got it. Yeah. No. Wait.
I'm not the liar. It's a different one.
Son of a God. I love that play, though. So fun. Lizette. You were really, was the really character. Good in
it. Yeah. And I remember that you came out right at the beginning and spoke to the audience. Did you have a cane or something like that?
I had a big staff.
Yes. You were a total clown.
Yeah.
It was wonderful. It was masterful. I never forgot
that. Oh. That's really sweet of you. I'm pulling up.
And Kat?
Yeah, remind me, Logan.
We would have met at Magic Theater.
Right.
Because I was the apprentice. I was Loretta Greco's apprentice at Magic Theater starting in 2011 to 2012.
Right.
And so through Rami or through other people that were working on Magic, I think we just like met through those like industry circles. And you were of the established, you know, the ruling class.
The ruling class that never worked at Magic Theater, ironically, never once. Still haven't. I've done readings and stuff there, but yeah, that's funny. Were you around during the Lily's Revenge?
No, I was right after that.
Okay.
So I the first play that I was a part of at Magic Theater was called Why We Have a Body by Claire Chafee.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. And then Bruja by Luis Alfaro was that year. Jesus in India was that year. Yeah, it was interesting time. It's a very different time than now.
Very different. Yeah.
Lots has happened in all of our lives, I would assume.
Yeah.
Okay. I have so many questions for you. And by the way, it was the heir apparent.
That's right. Great. I Kalia Davis is in that play as well.
Oh, that's right. Yep.
Yeah, it was a wonderful production.
That was a great production. I missed that show. So, okay. Thank you for jogging. I was like, what did we? That reading was really fun, too, of a non-player character. Ugh, so fun. So you just went to Yale.
Yes. I mean, I graduated in 2020.
Okay. All right. Well, how the hell was that?
It was, you know, the Yale experience, I would say, was completely life-changing and shocking, beautiful, it deeply inspiring, very challenging. It probably the most contentious, competitive environment that I've ever been in.
I've heard this.
Oh, wow.
At the same time, the most inspiring and also so valuable, just in terms of the resources that we got to work with and command. And
right.
It was such a disruption to my life. And I use that word disruption in the positive sense, because it kind of really shook up my expectations of what I was capable of.
Wow.
And the type of media that I want to be able to work in, you know, and I went in with a very specific expectation of what I was going to be accomplishing in my career. And I think because of that and all of those opportunities to work on a much larger scale, and then also everything that's happened with the pandemic and everything that has changed in the last couple of years, I'm in a much more expansive and chaotic place, I think, as far as what my trajectory as an artist is going to be. And I feel an intense sense of excitement and mystery around that. And it was a wonderful experience, and I wouldn't change anything about it. And particularly with the productions that I got to work on, which included Shakespeare and, you know, working on weird video game stuff and some film stuff and new plays and then an opera. So all of that was, you know, supported by just incredible, enthusiastic, supportive people.
So when you're in that, if I may, when you're in that program, do they assign you to projects or do you get to choose? How does it work?
So it's a mixture. It depends on, because there's the projects that are a part of like the curriculum.
Yeah.
And then there's the projects that just happen because you're in the proximity of these like really active and hungry artists and adjacent to all of the other sort of people that are at Yale. And the way that of the big projects work, the ones that are really like supported by the resources of the school, you get to propose two projects and then they pick one.
Okay.
That kind of like will also support the curriculum of everyone else. Because in that program I think that part of the reason why I think it's a great directing program is because they supply you with actors and designers and, you know, people that are of an extremely, extremely talented, rich artists that are, you know, that you, it is kind of like arranged marriages, But if you can come to the place of accepting that, like, okay, this is the person I'm working with, and so many interesting, just like, you know, fantastic creative encounters. And I'm as far as coming out of it into the pandemic, it was very, very strange. And because I was inside of this, you know, when we were there at that time, it was kind of like being in a nunnery. And like, we had 6 days a week of classes and rehearsals, and we weren't allowed to leave the campus at that time without having the signed permission of the faculty. I mean, not even on a weekend.
Wow.
Why?
Like, you were in military school?
Yeah, why?
Yes, absolutely. Just because they wanted to know your physical location. They wanted to be able to just make sure that you weren't going to miss anything. You weren't going to miss any appointments. And, you know, they don't want people taking work in New York City, and,
okay,
you know, which inevitably happens anyway for people. But they, you know, you really kind of like lock into this.
Wow.
You lock into this little cult.
Okay.
And then being inside of that system when the whole world was like changed in this huge way and fell apart, and you, like, the curtain was pulled back and you realize that so many people don't know what they're doing and what's happening. That was like this like double sense of disorientation for me and my friends.
Were you guys still, did you guys stay on campus through the rest of the, through the graduating semester, as it were?
Yes. So, we transitioned into remote, but at that point, nobody really knew what that was. So what they did is they kind of just like put together these, like, they basically identified the most high profile directors that they could get and then had them just come in on Zoom to speak with us. So we got like Julie Taymor to come in and speak with us, and Declan Donnellan, and people just like, but all of them were just like, what is happening? We don't know what's going on in the world or what the theater is anymore. And
we can't make anything. We'll just talk.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so, but other than that, I was just like sitting in my apartment playing Animal Crossing. Like, it was a very strange time. And then a friend of mine who also lived, I'm originally from the Seattle area. And so and that's where my parents are. And I realized, I was like, well, I can't exactly exit this program into like a job. I have no idea where I would even try to find that right now. And so I moved home with my parents. I drove across the country in 3 days, and that was in May of 2020. So there was like, hotels were not really feeling safe. And so, yeah, we like drove across the country, me, a friend, a collaborator of mine, and I, and then I, so was living with my parents, and that was my first time that I had like lived with my parents since I was in high school, which ended up being, and I was there for kind of off and on for like 2 years. And I think that on the surface, when I think about that, I'm just like, oh, I think that if it hadn't been for COVID, I feel like I would have had a lot of anxiety about that. But it ended up being some of the most beautiful, beautiful years that I've had with my parents.
Wow.
And I feel like we got to have conversations about things that have happened in the past that we never would have had if not for the pandemic.
Wow.
So yeah, so I was doing that. And I didn't really know what to do that summer. Typically, I have worked with a theater company that's outside of Seattle in my hometown of Kent. And we partner with the city of Kent, and they give this theater group that I work with in the summers a warehouse for free. And then we do performances and installations and plays in this warehouse.
Wow.
And so I had a lot of like connections from that, but I didn't, you know, we weren't going to do anything with that. So I was like, I will work at the food bank, because there's a lot of people that's where, you know, they needed some people to help,
yeah,
you know, lift boxes out of trucks and stuff. So I'm in the middle of doing that. And then some of my colleagues that work in the political sphere there were just kind of like, hey, like, we know you're an artist. Like, we have a little bit of money right now. Would you take some money from us and maybe make a little art project about stuff that's happening in the town right now?
Would you take some money from us?
Yeah. And I was just like, okay, great. And so I actually, from going to work at food bank, got to do this documentary film. And I was just like, I'll do a film. I've never done a film before, ever. And I was like, I will take a camera and I will go around and interview all the leaders of the town. And I will ask them about what's happening and like the politics of it. And like, I wanted to hear about Black Lives Matter. I wanted to hear about COVID. And so I ended up getting, so I worked on that for like 2 months. I was kind of like going around and talking to all the people in that community. It's a suburban community that's outside of Seattle. The arts organization that I work with is one of the few arts organizations that's there. And we got to just like do all of these like kind of in-depth interviews about like just all of the anxieties that were happening at that time. And then I taught myself how to edit in Premiere Pro. and like edited that project together. And then we just like released that on YouTube. And it was one of those things where I was just like, I made it with expectation that no one would see it and that it would be like, you know, played to the people of the town. And then after that happened, and then there was like all of this like intense controversy around it because of just like the conservative versus liberal feelings inside of that town and discussions of race and racism in that town, as it was reflected in this documentary when I have like the chief of police like talking about his feelings about racism on camera and stuff like that. So that I kind of just worked on that for a little bit. And then my theater company folks, everybody was like, well, we don't really want to do Zoom plays. And I related to that because I, especially as a director, I find it really difficult to connect with people with doing a Zoom play. So I was like, all right, well, we'll do films. Like we have no money. But everybody can do films now, so we should just be doing film stuff. And then we just started putting out like weird music videos with like green screens and three people involved with them. And we did like a shadow puppet film thing. And then we started doing this, like we fell into doing a stop motion animated web series that I ended up spending like a year working on. And because, you know, I had always kind of wanted to learn about filmmaking. And something that was nice about doing stop motion is that there's like, you know, you can work with, you know, a lot of my friends that are actors wanted to do voiceover stuff. And so we just started and I wanted to figure out what it was like to do a writer's room. So we kind of came up with a concept and we like hired writers from all over the country and did this like remote writer's room and then had like 30 actors from all over the, you know, all over the country to just like record themselves on their iPhones doing, you know, doing these animated voices. And then I just got to sit in my parents' attic and work with these models. We did it all with Legos and with, wow. you know, I pretended like I was still a Yale student and got like a discounted rate on all the stop motion technology and just kind of like using YouTube tutorials, just started to learn about the principles of animation and color and timing and editing. And then we partnered with this like symphony that wanted to support us because they, you know, so we like had symphonic underscoring to this whole thing. And we ended up, over the course of a year, we made like 2 hours of like stop motion animated content and put it out on the internet and then got to do film festival from doing that. And it was all just theater people that were doing that.
Wow.
And in the middle of that, I had like this horrible burnout and I was just like, I'm going to die and I don't know what I'm going to do. And then meanwhile, while it's been happening, one of my close colleagues from Yale was in the process of starting to sign on as a series regular on an HBO television program. And so she was brought to Los Angeles where I am now. She and I had worked together on the opera that we did at Yale. And, she now is like series regular on HBO and on Netflix and like doing a bunch of like really cool Hollywood movies and stuff. And so she tells me, she's like, I want you to come to Los Angeles and we will start a film production company together. And I was just like, I really don't have any idea what that is and how we would make that happen. But that sounds cool. I'm into that idea happening. And so when we finished up the stop motion animation, finally, which took way longer than I expected it to, and I ended up doing a residency, this LGBT nonprofit, and like, you know, finally got to move out of my parents' attic and like go into like an actual office to like build this studio out and finish this project. I like figured out how to come down to Los Angeles and I'm here for like 2 weeks, like figuring out how difficult it is to like apply for jobs online and all of that ridiculousness. And then another Yale person calls me up and it says, hey, there's this opportunity to direct a musical in Europe and I'd like you to do it.
Wow.
And so I ended up spending all of last fall working in on this musical, totally weird new Norwegian musical that was played in Luxembourg and it was in like 4 different languages over the course of its run and in all languages that I don't speak. But I happened to fall into doing this. And then there also was this animated film that was like made as like a part of that. And so it was really weird, kind of chaotic, but it was theater and got to be like experiencing the European system of how they produce experimental work. And so I kind of got like thrown into that world, which was a wonderful experience. And then like came back here to Los Angeles and then started just like doing totally random film and TV gigs and like assisting and sending in like application. And then I learned about that there was this like algorithm that's like, you know, block. There's this algorithm that you have to get past in order for your job applications to be read. And then sort of like working on all of that. And then there was a strike that started up in film and TV. And so when that happened,
heard about that.
Yeah, yeah. So when that happened, when that happened, my friend Elia was just kind of like, let's just make lots of work. Let's just like we'll write a pilot episode. We will line up all of these projects. And so we've just been working on that. And then over the summer, I got to finally go back to Kent and do a play, to work on a new play. So it was like my first play back since being at Yale, which was an amazing experience, and really enjoyed that. And also felt so much like affinity with that community and thinking about that. And then kind of just like came back here and then kind of like riding out the strike to be over, and then just working on it, kind of like a notebook full of ideas and weird seeds of things, and then planning stuff for next year, and then trying to like figure out my life financially and figure out what it means to be a person in Los Angeles and all of that stuff. And I miss the Bay Area constantly. Every time that I go back to San Francisco, I'm so just filled with happiness. I feel like I'm at home there, and I'm dying to reconnect there and get to work in those theaters again, figure out what that is. But also just kind of right now, I guess I feel like the last 6 years from when I started at Yale to now, which is like 3 years of school and then 3 years of like this pandemic transition craziness, I feel like that whole time I haven't really been in my comfort zone like ever. So that's been awesome in the sense that it's like really a lot of growing and being challenged, but also not feeling any sense of like safety.
Wow.
So it's but pretty cool, pretty grateful. And I have like, amazing family, friends.
I have two questions for you.
Yeah,
two things that are just pinging when you're talking. One is, this podcast like formally is sort of comedy and spirituality, but we go everywhere. We talk to awesome creators, whatever. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So one question I tend to ask people.
Do I need to be a little funnier? Should I try to funny it up?
No.
No, you need to be more spiritual.
Great.
Not at all. It's just that's our structure, whatever. But what I always find myself needing to ask just personally and when people come on is, like, if I say the word spirituality to you, what does that mean? What does that mean? Like, And it's so relevant to me with what you're talking about, because I'm like, okay, you got thrusted to the unknown and you're riding the waves of the unknown. It sounds to me like quite successfully, though it feels uncomfortable. Like, so I don't know. It's to me, it's like a vortex opened and you were thrusted to like, I have no net and I'm leaping because what else can I fucking do? Do you have a sense of like a connection to like, I don't know, anything at all? What does spirituality mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's, it's not something that I consciously think about a lot in terms of just like my personal, like going through the world. But I will say that it in some way, it keeps occurring in my work, in the stuff that I've been attracted to. And I'd say that like particularly this year with the play that I did at Theater Battery, which is a play called Deep Purple Wiggle, which is about the questioning of identity, but really about our connection to the universe.
Hmm.
And the set that we built for the play was a pool of water.
Whoa.
And this, and I don't know if either of you have worked with pools, like plays that are set in pools.
No.
But it was an extremely moving experience. It was like a presentness machine, the set itself. And we're talking like a very, very shallow pool of water that's very large.
Wow.
Like 20 feet square, like 20 feet by 20 feet, and then like about 2 inches deep of water. And it's in the middle of an abandoned building. And so it's kind of this like portal to Cthulhu. And it was black, like the base of the pool was black. And when it wasn't in motion, it was just like a glass. It was like you were looking at a reflection. And then when someone would step into it, all of these ripples would take place and we would hit it with light such that the reflection would hit the ceiling of this warehouse and you would see all of the waves in the ceiling.
Oh my God.
So when we did this, there were a lot of people that were just like really attracted to this contemplative pool. We ended up accompanying the play with a harpist. We had a live harp that was there that was playing with it. And then we had basically a local coven of witches heard about the production and came and wanted to do like a full moon ritual there. And we did that, which was a beautiful, incredible, just like moving experience. experience. And then we also had a drag show there and then a dance performance.
What didn't you do there?
We didn't, you know, we didn't like let audience members sink, swim, like get into the water or anything like that. We had safety tutorials and everything. And, you know, the
drag show happened in the pool too. They splashed around and
yes.
Love it.
Yeah. And we're talking death drops into this water. Like,
oh I can only imagine.
God.
It was very, yeah.
Have you seen Cirque du Soleil's O?
Yeah, no, I've seen footage from it for sure. And we were definitely
from inspiration. You have to see it. I know Cirque du Soleil is sort of like this commercial thing
it's
now.
Incredible. I love Cirque du Soleil.
You have to see O. You have to see it, particularly now that you've done this project. I want to tell you all about it, but I won't, because you need to have the experience of being in the room. It's shocking.
It's not a far drive. You're in LA now. You can just shoot over to Vegas.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's one example. But I would say that, like, you know, a connection to unknown is really feels very big for me right now. And also in general, trying to practice a sense of patience. And that's part of the reason why I wanted to do stop motion. And also to learn, I think just again, bigger theme over several years is just that when experiencing something that feels discomfort or something where it feels like I don't have the answer, that feels like for me, the moment to actually stop completely and to wait inside of what that uncomfortable sensation is.
Yes.
And allow for the answer to emerge from there as opposed to artificially generating an answer.
Okay, now, wait, I got to pause you because you're talking about there's three things I want to talk to you about. Now you're talking about point two. Remember I said I have two things for you?
Right.
Okay, point two is everything you've said since you've started talking sounds to me like, so there's a system that I study and teach quite deeply that's called human design. I don't know if you're familiar with human design at all.
Not at all familiar.
It's a complex type, very dynamic, very specific to the individual sort of typing system. It's like astrology meets the runes meets Enneagram times 50 million. It's very complex and specific and incredibly empowering for people in terms of helping people learn how they best make decisions and what's true for the self. And not, there's not like overarching, like this is truth and we're like a religion or even a spiritual system. It's like, here's what's happening inside of you through this mapping that we have. Now play with that and see if it resonates for you. And then it ends up being this like incredible tool for people's empowerment and awakening. When you're talking, you're describing, he's describing response.
Mm-hmm.
So generators, which are particular, there's five types, overarching types, and then there's all these complicated subcategories, or wait for the invitation. It could be either one. Anyway, you're describing what we would call a strategy of one of the five types that is, in fact, very hard for most humans to decondition enough out of the conditioning of the world to function from, right? We all think, like, just as you described it perfectly just now, what we have to do is like, nothing's happening. I don't know what to do. Let me artificially create something to happen so that I can fill the void and not be uncomfortable in the unknown. But what we would say in human design is each individual has what's called a strategy and authority. Strategy is how you're meant to function in relationship to time space. And authority is how you inside yourself know what's correct for you. So you're talking and I'm going like, man, he is effectively responding without manufacturing an action to take out of fear or a desperate need for control or something. And it makes me wonder, to whom or to what do you give the credit? Like, did your parents raise you that way? How did you develop the ability to sit in that uncomfortable place and wait?
I mean, I think that really came about when I feel like that came about when I was at Yale, because I feel like before that, I could be wrong about this. This is just my, you know, reflection on my own past, which is, you know, biased and all those things. But I feel like before that, I was trying to sort of follow some sort of path and script as far as like what I was meant to do in the inside of an industrial, like the nonprofit and theater industry structure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was trying to really like respond according to that playbook and to what I was and to the cues that I was receiving from inside of that situation. And I feel like when I was extracted into this other environment, which was much more about tapping into truth and artistry and to your connection to collaborators. Right. And connection to writing and to the just like the creation of other human beings, that I was repeatedly challenged to just to be able to wait past that sort of like first impulse.
Yeah.
And to actually see if I could uncover the deeper, more uncomfortable impulse.
Yep.
That is either existing in myself or existing in a room of people that are thinking about it. And I will also say that I've been in the long term working on finding that like the sense that something is wrong or something needs to be given air. I'm trying to find that sensibility, not in my brain, but inside of the other parts of my body.
Yeah, that's the deal. What do you do to facilitate that for yourself? The movement from the brain to the body?
I think my internal narrative, it just has to shift from trying to direct and in like never thinking about trying to direct, but really just thinking about like listening and viewing. That is like the core action of the core place that I'm in. And challenging myself as to whether or not intervention is necessary.
Right.
In the giving of a direction.
Mm. Yeah, it's good.
And and also like acknowledging the importance of iteration in our creative process across all media, which is the idea that like there's this version. This is just all that is released is a version of the idea. It's not like philosophically. At least I can't think about it like end product. It's more like this is a version. Mm-hmm. I think when doing stop motion, which was a lot of times that it was just myself doing it, but sometimes I would have a collaborator in the room or someone on Zoom. And what was beautiful about the process is that you could spend an hour on Zoom with an actor and you could record 5 episodes of their character's arc with, you know, just, and you'd have everything. You'd have all of their take of that work. And then it was about this process of taking that voice work and then painstakingly creating the movement of the character's body and the framing of the shots around them and what's happening with the other characters. And then you spend, you know, I could spend 3 hours working on, like, if you were going to give me a sentence of a character's line, I could spend a couple hours working on the animation of that sentence and then get to the end of that and watch it back multiple times and then have to make this kind of decision in myself of like, okay, I can either live with that and allow that to be what it is, or I can go back and redo it again and spend another 3 hours of sort of like life force doing that.
Yeah.
And then getting this, and then sometimes I would go one way and sometimes I would go the other, but getting into the practice of like accepting that like there, that neither way is going to reach some sort of perfection. That it's more just like, it's really just about making sure that I'm like delivering an audience into a thought. And just always allowing for that not to be like the idea of finished.
Yeah. You know, to that point, you're saying something that's it's bringing me back to, you ever find in your life that like what you knew when you were a teenager returns and returns and returns? Like for me, there was like a hormonal awakening that was
sure
at that time that I feel like I was an enlightened being.
Wow.
I like knew everything as a teenager. I really did. And then life, like conditions, you're just dealing with life and money and survival and judgment, and you forget and you have to. And then I'll get these flashes to be like, no, I remember who I was because I was it then. I was the truest Katie at that. Anyway, that's a side question thought, but
I relate to that. I relate to what you just said very deeply.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, especially right now. I have been very much thinking about who I was as a teenager recently and admiring myself for the abandon
yes
with which I pursued things and
yes.
And you know, and looking back, I don't know if you did you act in high school?
No, college.
Cassidy, did you act in high school?
Oh, 100%. That was my whole identity was, you know, theater kid.
Yeah. I mean, so I acted in high school And I also played music. I was in the orchestra as well. And I just very recently was just, you know, again, like getting to spend time with my parents and at their house, I got to look at recordings of myself as a teenager.
Okay.
And I just had, and it's one of those types of things where I feel like right after that happened for a couple of years, I would have been mortified to view that.
Right.
And to see that type of, you know, that very specific type of performative vulnerability of high school actors.
Right.
But now I'm coming back around to it and I'm just kind of like, oh, I didn't give a fuck.
Right.
I was not self-aware and that was helping me.
Yep. Yep.
In this other way. Now I'm trying to get back to that.
I get that.
Anyway, I want you to get back to your other thought.
Yeah. Well, so how do I say, when you're talking, it makes me feel like it's one of the things I feel like I knew in high school when I was I was really lucky to be surrounded by a lot of creative, really smart people. I had like this crew that sort of materialized out of nowhere in my second year of high school. I mean, we went on to be, you know, like famous film directors and like just like people who did like really cool stuff with their lives later. What I knew then was that there was something about artists that to me felt like it was the most true thing you could do or be, because in order to create art that is really transcendent, I think we have to live in the unknown and in the question. We have to stay in the energy of question. What is this moment? Let's play with this. Let's play with that. Then you've got to integrate play. Then you've got to bring notions that come from some mysterious, you could say spiritual other dimension into form. But so you've got to use metaphor and poetry to do that, because you can't be too literal, because then that kills the ephemera of it, mm-hmm. right? Whereas if you look at what a lot of spiritual systems are doing, is they're trying to lock it down. Spirituality is often, I think people take it out of what it is and try to lock it down, myself included. You know, what are the answers? The fucking podcast is called All the Answers because I want them.
Should
I
be
want
called the fucking- All the Responses. But not
all the questions and all the responses, but or all the iterations.
Ooh.
My point is, it's more spiritual, I think, to have to create art, because art requires a question and the unknown and the ineffable and a metaphor and the poetic. And those are the best approximations I think we have for articulating and embodying that which is ephemeral and beyond us. Whereas spiritual systems are often trying to say, here's the rules, here's what it is, here's the truth, as directed straight from consciousness or spirituality. So anyway, I was just listening to you talk, kind of remembering that, going, that's why I fell in love with art in the first place, is we're always trying at something as artists. Like we're doing our best to maybe it'll become the thing that's good, you know, or not. And but it's like you're birthing a thing which could die, and that is the mystery. That is the stakes are high.
Well, and as theater artists, it does die like that. We're one of the more ephemeral versions of that ephemera, so it's even more.
Sure, but I mean, in the birthing of it, when you put a play out or a piece of art out, it could work or not work.
Oh, that
and that death is the one I'm talking about, where it's like this attempt to articulate something ineffable. I'm going to try to articulate it and it might really not work, in the same way that when you go, I'm really on a thing here, but when women give birth, right, the baby might live, but maybe not. And also like, that's life coming from where? I don't fucking know. We understand the biology, but shit goes on and magic happens and people come into being and it's fucking weird. Anyway, so it's somehow to me, I feel like art and the way you were talking about it, you just reminded me, is somehow standing in and living in the unknown in a way that is more honest or something than any time we try to lock something down into a this or that, which, I mean, side note, but related, I feel like is connected to why the trans movement is so important, I think, because transness is the antithesis of this or that. It's It's all the things and none of the things and a brand new thing, but a thing that was always here. It's all the things. And so like, I don't know, I can't help but like see the world's awakening to the presence of trans folks and the world's having to deal with it as a form of spiritual awakening. Because there's no binary in that. And binary is always the limitation to the creation of the most effective and beautiful art.
Right or wrong.
Right? If you go like, what's the decision to make here? I decide this, as opposed to waiting in that moment that we're talking about and seeing what arises, et cetera. Anyway.
Right.
I don't know why you would have heard of this, but I started a theater company just now. A few minutes ago, a couple weeks ago.
Right.
And I'm going to produce The Totalitarians, Peter Nachtrieb's show. Do you know that show?
I don't know that show.
Oh, you should read that play. I think.
I mean, you should read everything that Peter's ever written, too, because the way he queers the world is beautiful. Like, he's an incredible, hilarious, one of the funniest playwrights you've ever read.
Black comedy, satire, farce about politics, but it doesn't say liberals and non-liberal. It says like politics is a problem. Anyway, it's very funny. And there's so much inside of looking at it, but also 900 things I want to tell you. One thing at a time. First thing is I'm really appreciating this conversation because it's helping me think differently about it. You know what it is? It's helping me land in the kind of thinking I want to be in as I approach the production. Like I know the play before and loved it, which is why I pulled it in to be the first piece. And so I have that old idea, my 2016 self's idea of what it is, but then we're not there now. We're here now. And I want to approach the production from the energy of question. Anyway, I'm excited about it. And we should get you out to direct something. Because that would be...
I'll be there. I will get in the car right now.
That would be so cool, Logan.
Happy to do it.
Oh my God. I love it. All right. We'll make something happen. Anyway, I think for me, this is going to take me back to a question for you. Right before the pandemic, I had really hit bottom with what I'll call right now, conflating the business of art with the love of the craft, like why we do it. I was fried from achieving and trying to be in these echelon places and fit the square peg of me into the round hole of whatever the fuck, and never ever fucking fitting, and then always being cranky and frustrated, and then thinking it's my fault, and then if I were thinner, if I were less loud, if I were less funny, all of that. And I hit bottom and I said, fuck the whole thing. I was having a hard time quitting though, because I'd worked hard to get to the little scraps of what I had.
Yeah.
And then I got injured because the universe is wise. My knee got hurt on the last show I did. I couldn't do it. I had to drop out of the production. And then the pandemic hit 5 seconds later. And I got this, like, I was given this, I see it like this time to just stop it and really own how brokenhearted I had become over all of the politics and all of the strategizing and all of the ladder climbing and all of the fucking games and just hating that, always having hated it. When I was a teenager, I wasn't like, you know what my vision of art is? Let me compete and climb the mountain to the top of the... That was not the vision. The vision was, I have these things to say and this stuff to create, and wow, we could really affect people, and wouldn't that be fun? And so I went through so many waves and iterations in these last 3 years of just like, I don't do that anymore. Fuck you. I do this other shit. Fuck you. Mad. And then I went through, I miss it, but I'm not going back to that. And right now I'm in this place of, okay, you know what? I definitely need to come back because it's a huge part of who I am, but it's happening on my fucking terms now. I could sob right now saying that sentence to you because I'm like, what it took in my personal work to get to like, no, I get to be the boss. Mm-hmm. I get to say, mm-hmm. I know, I can, and I know. And also part of being a leader, I think, is everything we're talking about, where it's like, even though I get to say and I get to decide, that ends up looking like I get to hold space for, I get to wait, I get to listen, which is everything the people who broke my heart in theater never could do.
Couldn't stop and listen.
It wasn't the point. The point for people was gaining some kind of fucking status. And So my discipline, I keep getting this message that my discipline with this, if it even lasts to be a company, maybe it's one thing I produce, who knows? Whatever it's going to be, my discipline is anytime I'm starting to get pulled into any of that, the status seeking and the cool factor, competition. I want excellence in the work and kindness with the people. Excellence in the work, kindness in the people. Mm-hmm. That seems like a basic, fair kind of way to fucking function, maybe.
That's very anti-capitalist, white patriarchy bullshit.
Right.
You can't do that. You're not allowed, because we need urgency. We need worship of the written word. We need power structure. We have undeniable hierarchies. We have, you know, none of those things are allowed.
Right. And you're right. And it is that there has to be a leader of the ship. I do believe like leadership, it matters, but there's a way to do leadership that is inclusive and holds space for and is open and receptive. It isn't taking your hands off the wheel entirely and going like, whatever the group says, but it's also not top down, what I say goes, my toxic nonsense trickles down through the system and now you're affected. Fuck it. And it feels very daunting, but also like, I wonder, and this is where I want to come back to you, ask you a question, Logan, which is like, I'm like, do you ever feel like, how do I say, it feels daunting, but it also feels like I feel like I'm at a point in my life where I'm like, the only choice left is to be 100% true to truth, to my sense of truth. And my sense of truth has nothing to do with amassing funds. I like nice shit. Cassidy will tell you. I like nice shit a lot. And, you know, I want to paint things pretty colors and have a nice...
Katie wants a jet ski.
I want a jet ski and I want a fuzzy couch. But we're going to die. We got a few years to hang around and then we'll be dead. Do I want to have spent it climbing some social ladder of appearances and whatever and amassing funds? Or do I want to have done something? Anyway, so it leaves me, I'm left with like, I have no choice but to make the work I want to make. I feel a little like there's no choice because any other thing is a lie to me personally. And I wonder, like when I hear you talk about everything you've been willing to sit through and struggle with and wait through, I go, you sound to me like someone who's like, there's not really a choice here. Like, I'm not like, now I'll be an investment broker. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that way? Like you, this is a calling and there's no way out.
Yeah. I mean, I've definitely had some moments where I'm just kind of like, wow. Yeah. Maybe I'd love to sell out. Let's sell out. Let's just do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for whatever reason, even when I am like trying to do that with what I feel like is my whole body, it just doesn't come back to me. It just doesn't come back to me. And,
I relate.
I gotta sit and accept that that's sort of like what it is. And also that would be boring. And for me.
Yep.
And I also think for the people around me that like being around me and that I want to like continue to, you know, to incite chaos with them. And I don't know. I guess I try to focus on piercing through what all of the politics are and what it means to be dealing with writing versus improvisation versus generative devising and like, or filmmaking or like all of that. I'm trying to just be like, you know what? If at the end of the day, then I can give someone a memorable experience. If I can give someone something that's worth thinking about and remembering, then the job has been done.
I agree.
And that's what it is. It's about a memorable experience, and for me, memorable doesn't even mean good.
Right.
It doesn't even, you know, and obviously I want good. You know, I want excellence as well, of course, but I also think that there is a gift in sort of the uncanny or in the strange or in the, you know, totally other, just like things that you can't control that are just a part of what it is to be making art now. Oh gosh, as far as like capitalism thing, I have way more questions about that than I have answers.
Yeah, we all do.
To give about it. I mean, I am so like, you know, just kind of trying to find that balance between being able to survive in a way that I feel like is humble and comfortable and respectful of the planet and also be excited to get up every morning.
I have a question for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you were going through all these sort of, I was seeing him sort of almost like a leaf on the wind experiences. Where it was like, oh, I guess I'm going to Kent. Oh, I guess I'm going to Europe. Yep. Oh, I'm making a stop motion film. Almost like it came to you and you said, that's what I'm doing. Were there any things in there that you were like, shit, what the fuck did I agree to? Did you ever regret any of those?
Absolutely. Oh, 100%. 100%.
I'm not talking just moments. Were there any full regrets? Like, nope, that one, no.
I would say there's elements of it was just like joyfully I can say that like I did that then and I'm so proud of it and I don't need to do it again.
Yeah.
Or it's like, oh, that was like a really rough space to be in for a little bit, but I'm so glad that I went through that. So I wouldn't say that I have any regrets about that time. And I feel like I'm still in that time, to be honest now, because, you know, not like, you know, it's like that freelance thing where you have these like tendrils and then suddenly something like really like, and then suddenly like a piece of meat enters and you're able to focus on that for a bit. But I would say that it's, you know, just lots of different experiences of having to cope with despair and also with the trying to find a way to roll with and embrace and love through the negativity that others might be going through.
Yeah.
And the unhealthiness that other people might be going through.
Right.
And just like acknowledging how many things are not within my control. I mean, I think that what stops me from really thinking about theater a lot during this time is just that how much I know from sort of like being a producer and being a director, particularly in a space where there's not a lot of other theater happening, is that I can even to generate belief inside of myself, I have to be able to generate belief within like a group of 10 other people and then in a group of 100 other people, right? And then maybe 1,000 other people, right? And to be able to encourage all of us to be able to get up out of bed and to enter the space, right? And that's something I feel like I'm still relearning how to do because that fire has to start inside of here and it has to feel like a belief and I feel like I learned so much from things that I need to now unlearn, which is just like you learn those, the editor that comes in and says,
right,
that's not going to work. That says, no, they're not going to show up, you know, or just like, this one isn't going to work. And you have to find a way to work with that voice.
Yep.
Which for me in the pandemic got really strong, right? That voice saying, no, it's unsafe. No, that's not going to happen. Right. Or no, this is too risky. And so trying to find like the right balance of that. And I also feel like I got told so much through the pandemic and then into now, which is this idea of just like, you can't do anything right now. You can't do anything right now. So you just have to wait. And that has been really interesting to try to like figure out how to live day to day inside of that.
Right.
Right. Because I don't want to live in the future. I don't want to live in when this is all resolved.
Right.
You know, or that sort of feeling. Because I could die tomorrow,
right?
Right, like it, you know, that can happen, and I don't want to have any regrets if that's the case. I want to be getting up every day and doing my absolute best, and then reminding myself that I'm taking care of myself in that way. And I think that one thing that I've come up with, you know, certain members of my family or just like people that are from a different mindset or from a different generation, is that, you know, in comparison to before I went to Yale, these years have been my poorest years of adulthood. Just financially, right?
Yeah.
And that, dealing with that strange paradox of like, wow, but didn't you go to the most elite institution in America?
Right.
Don't you have a master's degree? And you got all the prizes and like, I don't have any student debt or anything like that. Like, I was,
that's incredible.
You know, like, I'm very fortunate with that. But at the same time, it's just kind of like, oh, but, you know, I was speaking a little bit about algorithms earlier today. I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm one of those people that has, I don't know if you've heard about this thing, but it's like just in trying to apply for any old job, right? Or to work at the grocery store, to, you know, I probably sent in, you know, 200 job applications this year for different things. And I would say that, you know, 99% of the time, there's no response at all.
Wow.
Right. And
what are you, an actor?
I know. It's just, yeah, it's so it's very humbling. It's very humbling. And to anybody who might be listening to this, it's just kind of like, oh my gosh, like I'll go to such and such school and that will be like the golden ticket into
the
stable career of my dreams and fame and all that stuff. That's not true. You know, that's simply not true because it's still theater. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, something that I'm really searching for right now in Los Angeles is to find, you know, I have a portfolio of film work now that's accumulated in the past couple of years and a lot of theater work that I have to show that is stuff that I would feel is like very professional and very, you know, I'm very, very proud of that work. But, you know, to other people looking at that and their feelings about what that is or what that isn't.
Yeah.
Right. There's just so much about that that you can't control.
Yeah, exactly.
And to be able to accept that and, you know, yeah, it's just very interesting. And to just acknowledge that, you know, I think that, and I'm sure as actors, you know, so much more about this than I do, but it's, something, there is, of course, always your own responsibility for what's happening in your life. And I fully acknowledge that. And then there's also this factor that opportunities are given to us. And some of the time we are in a position where we have the energy or we have the resources and we have that to be the initiator to turn the key. And then other times it is up to another person.
That's right.
To give us that opportunity that might be life changing or might be really damaging in some way or all of that stuff. And just like respect that that's kind of what we're in, you know, and I feel a connection to just what this artistry is. And even though I kind of now think of myself as working in multiple media, I do think about myself as like a theater maker by birth.
Yeah.
And, you know, just looking back at our history and the ways in which people have entered the industry and fought to stay in this industry for the last, you know, hundreds of years, I feel like a lot of that has not changed. Even now, and sort of like where we are, I think that these questions and all of that is a part of our ongoing practice as a, you know, as a social role. I don't know if that makes any sense.
I just, I mean, I think you're talking about, I mean, I don't know, the way I'm hearing people talk about it is they go, what is the theater now? And, or they go, is theater dead? Or what, you know, it's funny because my reaction anytime somebody says that, I'm watching, obviously, what's occurring, which is all these huge institutions shutting down. And I'm watching rebirths of some and deaths of others, lots of deaths, and then weird survival of others still. And I don't have any idea what theater is or what's happening to it, but I know, like, I feel like at the end of the day, doesn't it all just come back to like, what do you need to do on stage? Like, what do you need to put up? There is no, what is theater? There's what do you need to create? Like, and then let's create it and invite people to come to it. And then also maybe treat people well, maybe try to be kind while being excellent. What else?
That's what we can do. That's what we can do. We can be good to each other, you know, and also work to see how we are in the same boat and in the same community and experiencing, you know, and we all share resources. That's just like a huge part of what is happening. Yeah. Especially when and then I say that, and then other times I feel like the way that the nonprofit system is set up is so competitive. And so, you know, every time that I have to sit down and write one of these grants, I'm just like, whoa, it's like,
I know,
really tricky to, and thinking about the right language to use and all of that, you know, the codes that we have in order to demonstrate worth.
Totally.
Oof.
that's really, really tricky. And it's a balance to be able to grow financially, right?
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I know. I know. We're right in the middle of like filling out the forms to become a nonprofit. And I always said, I'm like, I'm not going to do nonprofit. I'm going to figure out another way. And then when I look at it, I'm like, it's kind of the best way to go, because you could take, there's so much you could do that you can't do if you're for profit, you know. And then, yeah, and then exactly that, figuring you have to put certain language in certain locations in order to, right, display worth.
Right.
That's exactly, I love how you said that.
Yeah. And I mean, with the company that I've worked with the artistic director, Theater Battery, we just finished our 12th year. And I started that company with a group of friends from high school.
Wow.
You know, like, it, and now it's like a small, you know, small professional theater company where, you know, we're paying everybody to do stuff. And, you know, this year we were able to pay an hourly minimum wage to every actor, and like did like that, which was a huge milestone from us having gone up from like doing stipend work. But what we've also realized is that even though we don't pay rent on our space because it's donated to us, even though we don't pay rent on the space, we've reached a threshold where like the amount of grant funding that's available for our kind of region, we're at the upper limit of that threshold. And so there's like, oh, okay, well, where is up from here, and how would we get there when we don't know any millionaires? And, you know, it's just kind of like what that community is. And then I personally sort of am reckoning with like, oh, like how much time would I need to invest there in order to sort of facilitate that fundraising process, in order to sort of like keep that vision growing, or to think about the idea of sustainability of an institution, or all of that stuff. And so it's like a slowly approaching crossroads that I feel like is there for me to be able to deal with this running a small company. But I know right now I'm just grateful that we were able to even have a show and be able to sort of put something else up and have people show up to see it and that sort of thing. Yeah, I mean, I feel like as many times as I can say to myself that the rules have changed and things are different and you can't expect what you expected before,
uh-huh.
I feel like I repeatedly learn that. That is a lesson that I feel like I digest a little bit more each day.
What do you mean specifically? Which rules are you talking about?
I think that like the way in which to take that organization as an example, where it's like you think about something as you know, a small company that we were in this place of every year growing and growing in the amount of resources that we had, growing in the amount of audience that we were reaching, and you know, just like the ambition of what it is that we were doing and growing and growing and growing and growing, right? And then experiencing at once this like intense economic setback, which is the pandemic, a big slash in like the audience participation, right? And the way that we're connected to our audience, and then a huge blow to everyone's morale and to just like their capacity to sort of like give spirit to what's happening, right?
Right.
Which then plays out in not having enough energy to do sort of the volunteer level work that we're doing.
Of course. Yeah.
When we're giving it all to mid-sized theater.
That's exactly right. And so being able to sort of readjust, and then also for me, I don't know if you also feel this, but also being just like, oh, what are the ways that my body has changed?
Yep.
My energy is different than it was 10 years ago.
Oh yeah, for sure.
You know, my patience is different than it was before.
Yep.
And also there is that like pernicious capitalist ladder mindset, which is just like, oh, but wait, I did this work before. Like I shouldn't have to take a step backward.
Right. Of course.
Right. And which is in itself this a feeling of entitlement.
Right. It's ego.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes that's helpful. Sometimes that's really helpful for setting boundaries and being just like, no, I'm not going to do that.
Right.
And then other times it's in your way and you just kind of got to accept, no, it's different. You can't.
Absolutely.
You got to throw that out the window. You can't expect that.
And to me, that's what I call spiritual awakening. It's like, or you could call it emotional maturity. They're best friends. It's like, it's emotionally mature to be able to say, sometimes you got to say, yeah, I will do that for that amount of money because I want to bad enough and it matters. And other times, the emotionally mature choice is, no, I won't. And it depends. People want a playbook. It's always this or it's always that. And you can't.
And sometimes you, Katie knows probably what I'm about to talk about, but like you think you're going one way with the emotional authority or following that, which is contrary to the practical ladder mentality. So that's the right choice because I'm going against that thing. But then you get in it and you're like, this doesn't feel good. In fact, it feels extra bad. So I actually let myself down and I thought I was following spirit. I thought spirit was guiding me this time.
Right.
Now it was my head trying to follow spirit by being counter. I was still operating in, I'm doing this understudy gig right now that I'm just frustrated as hell with. I'm just like, why am I doing this? Why did I say yes? And I do have the feeling of I'm above this. Like my ladder put me above it. So I'm not going to listen to that ladder. I'm going to do it. But I was still operating in response to that as opposed to truly operating from spirit and making the decision, I think.
Or from authority.
Yeah.
Your authority. Yeah.
I wasn't really following. I thought I was following my authority. I was doing my best. And sometimes we do that. No, it's fine. We're living. I'm fine. But that you're also going to get those wrong too.
Right. Right. And I mean, I think that that's what's so important about friendship. I feel like I learned so. I feel like all of my friendships now have gotten very much deeper in different ways as I've gotten to this age. Just because of all the case studies, just because of being able to talk through. And I feel like this was with things having to do with family and dating and, you know, other personal matters where it's just like to have your comrades that are there to be just like, okay, like, here's the full situation and I will give you all the context of what's going on. And then to feel them also not know what to do.
Yes. Yes. That's helpful.
Validating.
I agree.
So that I feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a documentary I just watched, like binged. I think there's more episodes coming, but I watched all four of them. It's called Mormon No More.
Uh-huh.
And it's on, do you know about this?
No, I don't know, but it sounds fun. I think I would enjoy that.
It's on Hulu, and it's two women who were like married to men, one of them grew up from birth inside the Mormon church, and then was like, oh fuck, I'm in love with my girl best friend. And then it's them deconditioning and coming out and getting together, getting married, and their parents and the church. And there's a lot of LGBTQ activity happening at BYU now. Mm-hmm. And all through Utah, Mormons are like, I'm gay, deal with me, which is right. Fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, Utah famously has some of the best services for queer youth in the nation.
Right.
Particularly dealing with like the unhoused queer youth community and, it's particularly in response to what the Mormon church does.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's just been really cool to watch it on so many levels, but just like as a reminder of like what I'm taking from it a lot is just this thing kind of coming back to what we talked about for myself, where it's like, get to live on this planet another, 40 years, you know, if I'm lucky, if I'm doing well. What really matters and what's really true? And then just coming back to that over and over again, and then acting from that place. And these people were inside of I'm talking about people who before there was internet, literally the only things they'd ever seen were their Mormon temple, their Mormon school, their Mormon college, their Mormon family, and their Mormon friends. That's all they seen. And then inside of them is, I like people of the same gender. Uh-oh. But literally the only thing you've ever seen in external reality is, I mean, you get it. So just the bravery it takes to break out of a system that is that cemented in your being. They interview this, one of my most touching episodes. I won't tell all the details of it, but there's a young gay kid in the Mormon church who goes to a pray the gay away fucking camp or something, led by an ex-gay Mormon man who is the counselor he's like a counselor. He has a degree in counseling, and he takes these young boys out to the woods for these experiences that are supposed to like decondition them out of their fucking sexual feelings for men. Long story long, difficult stuff to hear about, really good stuff to hear about. And the counselor, 40 years into doing it, leaves his wife and comes out and is like, yes, so it didn't work. My bad. And in his wake are hundreds of boys who have since then had to go through years of therapy to undo what this one guy did. And what am I trying to say? I'm just sort of like, we're all dealing with, I feel like, on some level, conditioning that takes us away from or wants to or tries really hard to take us away from what really matters to us as individuals and what's really true for us, whether it's make your art no matter what or be fucking gay in your Mormon family, whatever it is, you know, there are forces at work. Call it, it's all the forces: capitalism, patriarchy, racism, sexism, misogyny, darkness, shaitan, energy, vampire, whatever. It's all there just messing around. So like, it takes so much fortitude though. That's what I'm loving about the documentary, the fortitude it takes these women to, as you said, as you get older, it's like, do we have the fucking energy anymore to push that boulder up the hill? And then somehow you find it for a day or a week. And then you're just like, do I have it anymore? And then somehow you find it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, very much so.
Fully inconsistent and unreliable. And such is the mystery. Mm-hmm. I am so glad you came today. Logan, I could talk to you forever. I unfortunately have to hop off and wrap up for today. But is there anything that you would like to tell our listeners? Like, come see this thing or?
Oh, well, I guess my one plug would be, if you're interested to like watch the stop motion animation that I worked on with my company, you can find it on either through my website, loganhollis.org, or through YouTube. And the title of it is Lego Harry Potter and the Transgender Witch. And it is the story of a young transgender child who goes to Hogwarts and experiences that. We kind of asked ourselves the question of like, okay, what would a transgender child experience as a student at Hogwarts? And, we worked on this project over the course of the year 2021. And partnered with an organization called Utopia Washington, which provides all kinds of different services and arts and access to the Pacific Islander trans community. And so that project is something that we spent a little bit of time talking about today that I would be excited to share. You know, a couple of years old now, but has played in festivals and primarily appeals to like 12-year-olds who are queer.
Nice.
But if you would enjoy that, then there's that, and then otherwise, I guess we can just look forward to our next theater collaboration and invite everybody to that.
I can't wait.
Awesome. So let me say it again: loganellis.org. That's ELLIS. Logan spelled like Logan.
Yes, correct.
All right. Well, thank you for being here, Logan. So good to see you.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm thrilled. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll be in touch.
Keep doing your work.
Let's do a play.
Thank you very much. Thank you. All right. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks, Logan.
What a sweetie. I love that guy.
Yeah, that was really nice.
He's so smart and he's so thoughtful about creativity. I always got that from him working with him on that one thing. He's someone who is just like thinking quite deeply about everything. Like we were just doing a little staged reading of a Aaron Loeb comedy. And fucking A, he just took it so deep, so fast, just by with his being and with the kinds of questions he was asking.
Nice.
And I just love an artist like that.
I love his willingness to just say, how do I learn to do this? Now, in order to do this, I have to learn how to do this.
Right.
I have a lot of admiration for that because that is something that I would like to see in myself.
I hear you.
So I'm thinking about that now. I'm inspired by that thought.
That's cool.
Right this moment.
Yeah, he inspired me with thought as well. That's really, I agree. I feel that way too.
Cool.
Well, thanks for talking, letting me vent at the beginning here today. I appreciate everybody listening and all you guys who listen. We love you a lot. And this is such a labor of love right here, what we do. And just you guys listening, there's nothing. If Cassidy and I are just farting at each other in the wind, it's kind of fun. We could do that anyway.
It's all right. Yeah.
Cycle with you guys when you send questions and when you ask stuff and when you want to talk. For me, it's everything. So
yeah.
Keep sending questions and feedback and whatever you have.
Anything. I asked on the last intro if people would just send us for their own, just for fun, what are your favorite episodes from the last 170 episodes?
I love that.
Also, that way, when we need to do a re-release, maybe we draw from that list.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. So. But send those in as well. And also, as always, we still would not mind at all, even a little bit, if you jumped on that Patreon and then told 10 other people to jump on that Patreon.
Yeah.
And let's get a little something going to sustain us in this, what we have agreed to as a capitalist culture. We are still in it. We need it.
Yeah. 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 And I'll include the GoFundMe for the theater somewhere in this, wherever you're seeing this or hearing this.
They should look for like Google, go to GoFundMe and then look for Third Line Theater.
Six Line Studios.
Fuck. That's me. I'm Third Line.
So here's a way to do it. Just go to sixthlinestudios.com and there's a window that pops up to contribute if you're interested.
Boom. There you go.
All right, my friend. I'll talk to you soon. I love you.
All right, my friend. Talk to you soon. Let's get together in the real human world.
Okay.
When you get back in town. I love you.
I'm looking forward to it. Love you, boo.
Bye. What are you asking for? All of the answers? Say what? All of the answers? Yeah,
all the answers. Hey, guys. Thanks for listening. We'd love to hear from you. Please email us with your questions so that we have questions to answer in the Akashic Records. Our email address is allanswerspod@gmail.com. That's allanswerspod@gmail.com. And if you'd like to find us on Facebook or Twitter, it's @allanswerspod. Thank you.
Yes! Welcome, first year witches and wizards, to your new home. Flibbity dum 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 tip tip.
Mixed and edited by Desmond McNeese for We Mixed It, LLC. Go to whatsoundsawesome.com.
Wizards, witches, and Hogwarts.